I'm Rebecca.
And I'm Kaylin.
And you are tuning in to Sociologic here on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from the very top of Burnaby Mountain.
We're stoked to be your host for the next hour, exploring local and global events using sociological perspectives. Thanks for tuning in.
And good evening, everybody, or good morning, wherever you are tuning in from. This is Sociologic here on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby Campus and Community Radio from Simon Fraser University, where we are located on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Halkomelem and Squamish-speaking peoples. Welcome to the greatest hour, some might say, on the radio. From now until 8 p.m, you will have me as your host, Rebecca, delving into some interesting sociological stuff. It used to be Kaylin and I. Now it's just me because Kaylin abandoned ship.
And me.
And Corey. Corey is a little guest, so I don't start the show off completely alone.
Oh, yeah. I'd like to debate that greatest show of the hour. I think the one before this show is actually amazing, but kind of biased. Yeah.
Slumber Party might, you know, just scrape up there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
might be fighting for top spot, you know?
Okay, I'll take it.
Fighting for top spot, especially on the Tuesday evening.
Oh, yeah.
On the Tuesday evening run. So, welcome. I have part two of last week's episode, which was sort of my introductory kind of episode into female serial killers and the sociological factors that can contribute to their representation and portrayal. So I'm putting a trigger warning out there straight away for all of those that have tuned in just now. I have some sensitive topics. I'm going to be talking about rape, murder, serial killers, abuse, suicide, death. It's a bit of a dark one again. So if you do not want to listen, feel free to tune out and tune back in at 8 p.m. with Bitcoover coming up. And you can just load up a previous Sociologic episode to listen for this hour. Preferably not last week's one because it is along the same topics. So, before I get into that, Corey's going to join me in what we are joyous about, or what's brought us happiness or joy this past week, as I think I actually forgot to do it last week when it was just me because Corey wasn't here.
No, I was not.
How dare she?
I know.
Yeah, tragic. Do you want to start it off? Or
I don't have one thing that I'm particularly I wouldn't say I'm joyful for this, but I'm very grateful. It's just that I don't have any back pain or any health concerns right now, because for some reason everyone I know my age has some sort of back problem or leg problems or chest problems, and I'm just sitting here.
She's thriving.
I am thriving. I have my legs are working, my arms are working, and honestly it feels nice to be able to move and not have to ache in pain or be uncomfortable in any sense. So pretty happy for that. Kind of stereotypical as well, since I'm a health student, but it is what it is.
That's very fair. See, yeah. I'm your like textbook hypochondriac, so I constantly feel pain. Like something's wrong with my body. But I get that. I can relate into the fact that I do think everyone around me is having some form of backache, mm-hmm. leg ache, all around like my age as well. And I'm thinking, we're not 50.
Yeah.
Like, what is going on? Like something's something's happening right now.
Yeah. Those darn phones.
Yeah. Darn technology.
Darn technology.
But that's a good thing to be grateful for. Mm-hmm. Grateful for your limbs and that you still have functioning movement.
What are you grateful for?
I feel like mine's kind of a weird one. It's not like grateful for. I'm more like it brought me happiness. Mm. Also brought me pain.
Oh, sounds lame.
Sounds a bit strange. But on Sunday, I went to my very first baseball game.
Ooh.
And I got heavily sunburned from it. So that's a bit of the pain part. I can relate to you when you spoke earlier.
Oh, yeah.
In the last hour of your sunburn. I too have suffered from horrific sunburn on one arm and my face. Not the other arm for some reason. I don't know why. But I got to go to my first baseball game. It was quite fun. It was like a lot, I don't know. I don't want to say the word boring, but it didn't feel like when I'd done the Canadian football games where everyone was sat there and it's a really big atmosphere. Like the baseball, a lot of people just kept coming and going throughout the game.
Yeah.
Like it's not a lot of people are just sat watching.
No, I think baseball is kind of more of a... It's interesting, but not interesting enough at every single point of the game. Not like soccer or volleyball or hockey when everything's constantly moving, but... Baseball is always just sitting and waiting for someone to hit the ball.
And if they don't hit it after, what, three hits, is kind of like...
They walk.
What was the point?
Exactly.
So, yeah, but unfortunately, it was also a bit of a sad thing because it was the last time I saw my Irish friend because she's going tomorrow to do Camp America. So, and she comes back to Vancouver after I leave Vancouver. So it was the last time I saw her, so... It was fun because it was both of our first baseball games. We got to see each other and hang out one last time. We also had another friend who's from England that joined us for drinks afterwards. Watched the sunset. It was very peaceful, very pretty, very nice. Just a bit of a, like, it was happy but sad moment when you realize, damn, I'm not going to see you then at least for a year because I'm going back to the UK. And she's applying for, like, PR and starting her master's out here. So she's obviously going to be here for a little while.
Yeah, bad overlap.
Yeah. It's a bit of a, like, sad tinge to it. But, yeah, that is what brought me joy this week. I encourage all of you listening to think about your past week. What was something that brought you joy? And if you cannot think of anything, maybe next week, try really extra hard to do something that will bring you joy and happiness. Because it can be as simple as a dance party in your bathroom, which has become one of the favorite parts of my days. I do that regularly now.
Nice.
I have a massive dance in my bathroom whilst I'm, like, getting ready for the day. Sets you up really well.
Very necessary.
Very necessary indeed. And speaking of that, I'm going to play some songs now before we get into it because I don't want this hour to just be a kind of darkened... I don't want to say depressing because I find it very interesting, but maybe not the, like, most lighthearted of topics.
Maybe tinge it with some bathroom party songs.
Yeah, some bathroom party. I wish, but they're all, like, mainstream. So, unfortunately, we do not play mainstream music here at CJSF. Well, not unfortunately. We give the airwaves to those that need it more. Taylor Swift.
No. Sorry, Taylor.
Sorry, Taylor Swift. You have a lot of airtime. So we're going to start off with a song that I found from the playlist here at CJSF. It's a FemCon song called Back in Town by Annie DeRusso off of her album Super Pedestrian. It is a clean edit. I'm going to put that out there. So if you want to listen to the explicit version, feel free. This one is not that. And we'll be back for the topic.
Swore I would take to my grave the fact I changed my flight out of Chicago just so I'd see you one more time. Met you at that beach you love on the north side. You told me your friend says I've got pretty eyes, but you don't tell your friends. You pick me all the time. Now you're somewhere in Idaho, letting me down again. Yeah, I know, I should know by now. I heard from a friend you're still sleeping around, but give me a call when you're back in town. I wanna give you my all when you're back in town. Yeah.
Welcome back to Sociologic here at CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. That previous song you just heard was a German song, actually. It's by a German artist. There is an English version, but I actually kind of just wanted to play the German version as a bit of a switch up. It's called 99 Luftballons or 99 Red Balloons by the artist Nina off of the album 99 Luftballons, and it was released like 1984, and I just think it's a really kind of cool beat. And then the song before that was Back in Town by Annie DeRusso off of her album Super Pedestrian. And yeah, if you've just tuned in, hi, I will be your host for the next hour. My name is Rebecca, and I'm gonna put a trigger warning out there that tonight's episode is a part two of my episode last week, which was about female serial killers. So we are touching upon some heavy topics such as serial killers, murder, rape, suicide, death, a lot of stuff like that. So please tune out if you do not want to be listening to any of that. I will not blame you or hold it against you. You can put up another Sociologic episode from the playlist, or you can just listen to something else. I won't be offended either. And tune back in at 8 p.m. for Bitcoover with our music coordinator, Connor. So getting right into the topic, I'm going to be touching upon kind of how violent female offenders are portrayed as unfeminine through hidden patriarchal structures, and lesbianism being a key role in that as well, and kind of relating it to some key case studies and the media representation of these case studies. So I'll be talking about the Lucy Letby case, which is very big in the UK, the Amanda Knox case, and Eileen Wuornos and Andrea Yates. These are some very prominent female serial killers, or just female violent offenders. So yeah, there is this idea that there is a polarization between femininity and being unfeminine, which is sensationalized through a mad, bad, or sad categorization. And the media enforces this to ensure that society conforms to traditional patriarchal gender expectations and roles, as the media is a key institution in feeding into the structural systems of society. So women who kill are portrayed as an aberration of true womanhood, because the portrayals often downplay information that might actually contextualize or explain the woman's actions. They instead focus on the perception of them. So this is a patriarchal tool to keep the like gendered stereotypes conformed to, and it's done by categorizing them often as unfeminine, and that's through like demonizing them or polarizing them as far away from stereotypical traits associated with femininity. And so this will heavily focus on details of their appearance and their sexuality, commonly emphasized through sensationalist headlines and imagery. So there's that, but there's also that women who kill are seen as doubly deviant, because they're not only deviant in terms of the fact that they've killed someone, so they've broken the law, they've done one of the most inhumane things, but they also breach the social expectations and gendered stereotypes of a woman. So women who kill are seen as doubly deviant, whereas men who kill are just seen as deviant because violence is an association with masculinity. So there's a double standard already shown in deviancy as well. And I have a quote that I think is a really kind of interesting quote by Kahn from 2007 that really kind of sums this up. So it says that the violent actions of women and the response they elicit from the media, feminists, and the legal system significantly impact society's effort for gender equality. When female killers are depicted as monsters, the agency denial which takes place is specifically that of human agency. The murderess is considered to have acted, but not as a human woman. And so this kind of sums up something that I was very interested in when I first thought about doing this topic for Sociologic, in that in no way, shape, or form am I encouraging violence, murder, anything like that. But it's interesting how when a woman kills, institutions in society immediately try and remove the agency and autonomy of her choice to kill by having to justify it through categorizing her in a mad, bad, or sad, which I'll get into as to what that is. But they have to justify her choice to kill as being a consequential reaction to something rather than her just having the autonomy and agency to choose to do that. That is not given the same to men who kill. Men who kill is just sometimes seen as they just wanted to. They had the agency and autonomy to do that. And I've had this big debate over, well, not debate, but interest in autonomy for women and women's kind of lack of autonomy, or the more restrictive society is on female autonomy, on intravenous. I've had a couple episodes talking about it because I think it's something that's increasingly becoming prevalent in discourse for gender equity and things to do with women's issues, particularly when we look at the current political state of a lot of countries in the world at the moment and women's rights kind of being taken away from them without them having a say in it, or things being decided. Like reproductive justice is a big one, of like women not having the own autonomy over their own bodies, as a very prominent one that I think a lot of people will know what I'm talking about with that. So I find it interesting if you apply it to deviancy and you apply it to people who break the law, you apply it to female killers, because female killers are not talked about a lot because they subvert the societal expectations of women so much that they kind of just get placed in a box and put away. No one really wants to talk about it because it's seen as like so, I don't know, even know the word, so polarizing to what a woman should encompass. But who decided what a woman should encompass? The patriarchy. So it's interesting in that aspect. But anyway, the mad, bad, or sad theory is one that's kind of become more prevalent. It's become more kind of used in terms of this, as there's a very prominent case called the Lucy Letby case in the United Kingdom, which this has been applied to a lot. So it is about how violent female offenders are categorized as either mad, bad, or sad through the media representing them that way in their typography or their imaging. So it's often to make them have a perception of being unfeminine, usually. So this is because violent female offenders, as I've said, directly oppose traditional gender roles and stereotypes. So theorists note that there's gendered roles are usually rooted in biological theories. So women are said to have maternal instincts to be caregivers, be compassionate, be quiet, be submissive. So this directly constructed those stereotypes that societal systems utilize. And that furthers the extent in which unfemininity is associated with violent female offenders. And not only do these portrayals in the media polarize violent female offenders as far away as possible from what a woman should represent and their femininity, but it also solidifies to society what characteristics are associated and constructed to what characteristics are associated to construct femininity. So it actually also reinforces those patriarchal norms and values that are associated with being a woman and that are believed to be collectively sought after. So if we look at the mad category, there is also, these are very interconnected. There's a lot of overlap in mad, bad, and sad, as I'm sure you'll find out when I speak about it. But the mad category is portrayed kind of like with the strong associations with mental illness or a medical kind of illness. Often female killers will be portrayed as, these are the quotes, demented castrator or drug addict, because it links their violence to a mental health aspect. Not that they just have the own autonomy to be violent, but that's it. But it limits the amount of responsibility they can take for their actions. So if they were portrayed as bad, they take all the responsibility for their actions. So it reduces the autonomy and agency with them, which could be strategic if the female violent offender wanted that, because it does often lead to a leniency when it comes to sentencing that is similarly seen with the sad categorization as well. So you could see in some case studies that the perpetrator, the female serial killer, could have been purposefully trying to represent herself as having a mental illness or being crazy or something like that in order to get leniency when it came to sentencing. And there is actually a leniency thesis that enforces this, that argues that judges in the criminal justice system are more lenient to certain groups in society, especially women. So this is due to feminine stereotypical characteristics again. So if they show remorse or emotion during their trial, for example, if they're a mother, that's a very key characteristic that can get leniency and things like that. So the mad narratives, though, are not always explicit until the sentencing. So if there's an arrest made, it's not always explicit from there. Or if the perpetrator was moved to a lunatic asylum or something, it would often be seen post-trial. So unless they were outwardly expressive during the trial, most often or not, the categorization of mad would happen post-trial. The one case study that is very prominent for this is Eileen Warnos, who I spoke about last week, who was convicted of murdering 6 men and suspected of murdering a total of 7, but one body was never found. She was thought to have had genetic factors linking to schizophrenia, since her biological father, whom she actually never met, was diagnosed as a schizophrenic and committed suicide in prison. So there was a lot of talk over whether she was schizophrenic as well, because she had a constant change of persona during her trial. She presented herself as a victim of sexual abuse and rape, where she was categorized in the sad category. And she was in a lesbian relationship due to her traumatic past with men. But then suddenly, during her trial, she converted to Christianity. She presented herself as a feminist icon who murdered men who were sexual predators, turning away from lesbianism to paint a picture that she was more feminine and a reformed character. She really played into the femininity part. And this is probably to gain more leniency from the jury and to avoid the death penalty, which she didn't. And to do this, she conducted what we call face work, where she was just kind of putting on multiple different faces. So she was constantly shifting the narratives that surrounded her, and her motives were going from like hero to villain or from victim to agent. So it highlighted these very inconsistent attempts to conform to the submissive societal stereotype of what a woman and femininity is. Because usually if you're portrayed as a female who has killed or being accused of killing someone and you're portrayed as unfeminine, you're going to receive a harsher sentence than if you're perceived as very emotional, very expressive, things like that, very weak. You would be portrayed differently. So this was seen in the case study of Andrea Yates. So she drowned her 5 children in the bathtub. Now, she was put in the kind of mad and sad categorization. Like I said, there is overlap. But she was actually found to be suffering from psychosis due to postpartum depression that caused her to drown her 5 children. So she was actually remanded to a mental hospital instead of being put in prison or on the death penalty, which is different to Eileen Warnos, because she was just flipping from different narratives so much, the jury just found her guilty and she was sentenced with the death penalty. So those are kind of where the mad categories can kind of categorizations happen. With the bad, this is probably one that is more associated with masculinity. So violent female offenders, you'll often see are demonized through media's representation of them. So it makes them appear as far from the stereotypical image of femininity as possible to reinforce the patriarchal structure of society. So the media will depict them as monsters because they've broken what is considered to be the fundamental natural rules within femininity, and the media will sensationalize this because it reflects the sensationalized nature of the actions, because society has this view that women who kill are, it's so rare and it's so horrific than if a man kills, because violence and aggression is associated traits to masculinity. And this is not only a tool of demonizing unfeminine qualities and things like that, but it's also a tool to attract a larger viewership. Now, this can be for 2 reasons. This could be for a desire to ensure as many people see this demonized portrayal, because it will reinforce the patriarchal systems that oppress women to be staying in their gendered, like their stereotypical gendered role. Or it also has a capitalist aspect to it, in that the more sensationalized the portrayal through the typography and imaging, the more people will engage with it, which helps the outlet's success.